16. The cliff soared far above, reaching over Svetlana in a dizzy overhang laced with ominous fissures. The carving of chunks of ice had slowed since the early days of Janus's departure, but large breakaways still happened occasionally. The odds against a carving event happening while they were under the overhang were comfortably low, but Svetlana still could not rid herself of a knot of disquiet. She looked back, making sure that Parry and Nick were not too far behind her. They had trudged 50 meters north from the squatting form of the parked lander to the fiery ribbon of the lava line. It boiled orange, searing through the ice like a path of burning gasoline. In one direction, the line curved away to the horizon. In the other, it vanished into a blocky ice-covered chunk of spike and machinery the size of an office block. Where there was no ice build-up, the lava lines were observed to float just above the underlying machinery, unsupported except at the point where they entered or left the interior of Janus. Robots had been sent under the lines, but had detected no peculiar field effects. Ahead, something was wrong with the line. Instead of following a customarily straight or gently curving trajectory, the line suddenly kinked, veering to one side at almost a right angle. After the kink, there was something subtly amiss with the line. The orange had taken on a pink tinge, and the diameter of the fiery tube was pinched. It looked stressed, like something about to snap. Svetlana allowed Thale to step ahead of her and lead the way, traversing the path that the line would have followed were it not for the kink. "Don't straighten out now," she thought. "Nothing's come out to fix it," he said. "Maybe it's on a to-do list somewhere inside Janus, or maybe it just doesn't know or care about this one breakdown." "Ice did this?" Parry asked. "Ice and rock," Thale said. "Sometime when Janus was parked around Saturn, a piece of chondrite rubble must have splatted onto the ice. When this part of the shelf collapsed, it took the boulder with it. The boulder smashed into the lava line just as a transit was passing." Parry and Thale had been doing most of the talking since their departure, filling awkward silences with a strained attempt at small talk. Thale and Svetlana still didn't see eye to eye, despite his release from custody and the grudging changes Svetlana had made to the terms of Bella's exile. 6 years into the human settlement of Janus, the wounds were still raw. For months on end, the colonists would muddle along as if the old grievances were history. For many of them, with their marriages and children, that was the case. But a few could not leave the past alone. Every now and then, something would happen to remind Svetlana that the crisis on Rockhopper had not been forgotten. Would never be forgotten. Even if the troublemakers had no intention of changing the political situation in Crabtree, there were still scores to be settled. Most of the time, their actions never went beyond threats and intimidation, but occasionally something more significant happened. Every apparently accidental death on Janus had to be examined in the light of past events. Meredith Bagley had been the latest unfortunate victim. She had been working on routine centrifuge repair, squeezed deep inside the drive mechanism, when the centrifuge started up. The preliminary investigation revealed that certain safety interlocks had not been set, implying that she'd been in too much of a hurry to get the job finished. Meredith Bagley had been known as a conscientious and thorough worker, but there was also the matter of what she had done on Rockhopper. When Bella had gone behind Svetlana's back to check the sweatbox numbers on the fuel tanks, she had done so with Bagley's visible assistance. Svetlana's allies had viewed it as a kind of treachery. Most of them had forgiven Bagley by now. She'd been young, newly rotated aboard the ship, and consequently unlikely to refuse a direct order, and most were content simply to give her the cold shoulder. But that still left the possibility of a small core of loyalists who might feel that Bagley hadn't been adequately punished, loyalists who thought they were obeying Svetlana's private wishes. Already there were rumors that she wasn't exactly displeased with the outcome. More than likely, the death was exactly what it looked like, an accident rather than murder. Even good workers cut corners when they were behind schedule, with someone shouting at them to get the centrifuge up and spinning again. But even the slightest suggestion of murder could not be discounted. The judicial apparatus had to look into all the angles before it closed the book. Bagley was just one case. Every accidental death was investigated with the same diligence. Likely suspects were brought to the high hab and quizzed. No one liked it, and it certainly wasn't helping to erase the old divisions, but it wasn't the duty of the judiciary to bury the past. Dealing with men like Thale didn't make it any easier either. He'd nailed his colours to the mast pretty clearly when he tried to spring Bella from prison. No doubt where his loyalties lay, Svetlana thought acidly, but no one else on Janus had spent more time studying the lava lines than Nick Thale, and the knowledge he had accumulated was simply too valuable to lose by shutting him away. Not for the first time, Svetlana was grateful to have Parry around. He was the one crew member no one had a problem with. The Lind loyalists knew that he'd been generous to Bella, so they forgave him his choice of wife. Even Nick Thale appeared relaxed in his presence, far more so than when he was forced to deal with Svetlana. But in spite of her husband's comforting presence, Svetlana would still be glad when this particular expedition was concluded. They could see the transit now, stalled a little further along the lava line from the kink. It was the first time she had seen one up close. Normally they were moving too fast for the human eye to follow. Knocked off its course by the boulder, this transit had come to an abrupt halt, lodged against a chunk of protruding machinery. The transit's outward form was very simple, a pair of thick, coin-shaped endplates floating independently of each other, with the cargo trapped inside a suspension field stretched between the inner faces of the endplates. But this transit was damaged, bent out of shape by the impact. The endplates were twisted at an angle to each other. The stressed, constricted lava line had broken up into finger-like tubes, playing over the endplates like St. Elmo's fire, and etching a weird pattern of bronze-coloured erosion into their pewter-grey surface. Beyond the transit, the line kinked back onto something resembling its original path. The broken transit had spilled its cargo. The suspension field was still active, a flickering, writhing cylinder between the endplates, but the freight had escaped from its confinement through some point of weakness on the near side. Plates, coils and tubes of dull material lay scattered in a fan-shaped pattern on the ice, like an eruption of entrails through a hernia. "You think we can just take it?" Parry asked, when they had come to a halt, the toes of their boots only a few meters from the edge of the cargo. "My guess is nothing will stop us," Thale said. "When the ice thins out, maybe this stuff will be reabsorbed into the normal machinery, or maybe it'll just form a garbage layer on top like a dead skin." Parry fiddled with his helmet visor, snicking glare filters in and out. "No other transits have come out on this line?" "Not since the boulder came down. There was never much traffic on this one anyway, maybe one or two transits a week. If they've been rerouted onto other networks, we'd have a hard time spotting the difference." "Any idea what the stuff is made of?" "Difficult call unless we take some of it back to Wang's lab." "It looks like metal," Parry said. "Lead or something. My suit isn't picking up any rise in the background rads, so I guess it probably isn't radioactive."
"Oh, the suit's faulty," Svetlana said.
"Yeah, that too." Parry managed a gallows laugh. "You think we should try to take some back now?"
"I'd rather we sent in the robots first," Thale said. "If this is some kind of trap or setup, or if the materials turn out to be toxic, better to let them take the risk."
"I don't know if Saul can spare any robots for a few days," Parry said.
"Come on," Thale said, his tone skeptical. "Is it really that bad? I thought that was just the party line to keep us knuckled down."
"It's worse," Parry said. In the last few months, breakdowns and accidents had thinned the robot pool to a dangerous low. Complex artifacts, such as microprocessor boards, needed equally complex blueprints specified down to atomic scales. For most of their machines, no such blueprints existed. Wang was doing his best, combining the VAT's built-in library files with a certain amount of reverse engineering, but so far he hadn't come up with much that actually worked.
"You must be able to pull some strings, though," Thale pointed at the strewn cargo. "This is raw material. It's what we've been waiting for."
"I'll see what Saul can spare you."
"We don't have to wait for Saul," Svetlana said. "There isn't time. We need to know if this stuff is any good, and if it is, we need a strategy for stealing more of it."
And then she walked forward.
"Svieta," Parry began.
But she was already on her knees, pushing her gloves into the ice under the nearest dark grey slab.
"Feels okay," she said. "My fingers aren't tingling or anything weird. It just feels like a chunk of metal,
Really hard. It's moving, I think. She whistled.
Fuck!
It's heavy. Must be denser than anything we use. Parry and Thale stood either side of her, caught between fascination and alarm. She heaved at the slab until it lurched free from the ice in which it had buried itself. It came up easily then, although it still felt heavier in her hands than anything she had ever handled under Janus's gravity. Feels like a slab of concrete or something. I don't want to even think about what this would weigh under a G. We've got to be talking tons.
Be careful with it, Thale said. It'll still have inertia. If you drop it on your foot, you will feel it.
Gather up some of this stuff, she ordered. We'll load as much of it into Crusader as we can take, and keep an eye on your Sheng boxes.
They were nervous at first, like children stealing apples from an orchard. But after three or four trips to the lander, following a different path each time to avoid tripping the route repetition alarms retrofitted on their suits, it began to dawn on them that Janus simply did not care what they did with the spilled cargo. Only a certain disquiet about getting too close to the containment field prevented them from removing the entire catch. That would have to be a job for the robots, when they could be spared. Back in the lander, as it carried them aloft with tons of grey treasure in its hold, they couldn't suppress an elated feeling of breakthrough. Svetlana put in a call to the creche and said hello to her daughter, who was busy finger-painting with Danny Mayer. Danny and Emily were about the same age, and appeared to communicate on some channel incomprehensible to adults as they explored new parameters of messiness. Emily held her latest creation up to the cam, yellow and orange smudges that might have been flowers, a smear of blue along the top that might have been sky. She had never seen sky or flowers. Svetlana wanted to cry, but she kept it together. Then she called Denise Nadis and told her to prepare for their arrival.
As soon as we're down, I want Wang on the case, she said. We have power now, and all the ice we can use. For once, we may even have materials.
It's good, Parry said when she had finished the call. But let's not get carried away with this. We scored lucky this time, maybe. But we can't expect something like this to drop into our laps every week.
That's up to us, she said. Janus has shown us a way. Now all we have to do is copy it. If nature can do that to a lava line, so can we.
Thale opened his mouth a crack, but said nothing.
What's up, Nick? She asked, missing nothing. You don't think we should take what's there to be taken?
I'm not one of those idiotic cultists, he said. I don't think there's anything sacred about this place. It's a fucking machine. On the other hand, I'm enough of a rationalist to believe we ought to be careful about provoking a reaction. I didn't notice any reaction back there. Maybe we weren't poking hard enough. Start dropping bombs on the lava lines, and maybe you'll cross that threshold.
She shook her head, disgusted by his timidity. Perhaps it's me, but I don't remember giving permission for Janus to pull us away from home. We've been pussyfooting around too long. It's time to start making this place work for us.
You always did think like an engineer, Svieta.
She nodded. It was only hours later that she realized he had not necessarily meant it as a compliment. One day, halfway into the seventh year, Ryan Axford called Svetlana to the medical center. He had offered no explanation for the summons, but Axford would not have troubled her without excellent cause. Her contact with him had grown sporadic since Emily's birth, even more so since the passing of Jim Chisholm, but she still placed complete faith in his professionalism. The medical center was a different place now that Chisholm was gone. Busier than ever, the influx of the children saw to that, but Svetlana could feel the absence where Chisholm had been. He had spent so much time in this place that he had left a kind of psychic imprint on the surroundings.
What is it? She asked when Axford had closed the door behind her.
You ask to be told, he said. She looked at him blankly.
Told what?
If there was any change.
Any change in what?
She snapped, a little exasperated now.
Axford's thin, time-worn face conveyed amusement.
You barely remember, do you? He's been up here so long, never changing.
Her jaw fell.
Craig.
For a moment, boyish enthusiasm stripped away the years, and she glimpsed something of the younger Axford.
He's coming out of it, Svieta. After all this time, I saw something human in there today. I think there's hope after all.
Is he talking? The odd word, a sentence, now and then, more than we ever expected or hoped. Svetlana was surprised at how glad she felt. She had never seen eye to eye with Shrope on Rockhopper, and Shrope's strategic alignment with her cause had been so transparently self-motivated that it had done little to improve her respect for him. But what Shrope had become since then was so pitiable that she could not help but feel sympathy for him.
"What happened?" she asked.
"Time," Axford said. "The great healer. There's some truth in that, you know. And the one thing I can say with certainty is that he's had a lot of time.
Can I see him?
It's about time he saw a few new faces. It might help him along." He raised a warning finger. "But go easy. It's early days yet, and I don't want him pushed back into that shell." Axford led her to the room where they kept Shrope. Svetlana hesitated at the high, small-windowed door.
"Maybe this isn't such a good idea, Ryan. How much does he actually know?"
"Both much less and much more than you'd think. I don't have much good news to offer him. If he thinks we're getting back to Earth any day soon." Axford answered softly. "He doesn't. I've established that much. You don't need to soft-pedal the truth. Just go easy, one step at a time."
"I'll be careful."
Shrope stood up as she came into the room. He'd been sitting in a chair next to a small bedside table. He put aside a book, not a flexi displaying text, but one of the very few actual printed books Rockhopper had been carrying, and which now formed a small and treasured library, like the valued collection of some medieval scholar. It was a dog-eared legal thriller entitled The Firm.
"Hello," Shrope said. "It's good to see you," she replied, the words spilling out in an automatic utterance that sounded flatly unconvincing, even to Svetlana.
But what did she really feel? She had never liked Shrope during their days aboard Rockhopper, and she had despised him when, as she was now certain had happened, he had persuaded Bella that she needed to be removed from duty. But this was not really Shrope. This was some pitiful, fragile, damaged thing that had been shattered into a thousand psychological pieces and then glued back together in some haphazard approximation of its former shape. Hating Shrope now felt redundant, even spiteful. If she could hate a bullying child and yet feel empathy for the same child lying ill in bed, then she could feel empathy for the man who had once been Craig Shrope. He looked better than she had expected. Now, at least, he was out of pajamas and into normal clothes, even if they only ran to a drab grey T-shirt and a pair of white jogging pants. His hair was thicker, no longer shaved close to the scalp. There was an alertness in his eyes that she did not remember from her last visit.
"I'm sorry."
He paused, losing the thread of whatever he had meant to say.
"Easy, Craig," she said gently.
"I'm sorry for the trouble." He looked abashed. "All the trouble I caused."
"It's all right," she said.
"No." He stood before her with his hands dangling at his sides. "I should have." He shook his head, exasperated with his own efforts.
"Difficult. Sorry.
Take your time. No one's in a hurry. I let you down. Should have pulled myself together." Svetlana felt a wave of magnanimity pass through her, all their enmities abruptly forgotten.
"You were never any trouble, Craig. It's just good to have you back with us."
"I'm glad to be back," he said earnestly. He lowered himself into his seat again and gestured towards the neatly made bed.
"Sit down, please."
Svetlana sat on the bed.
"You're doing fine, Craig. Better even than Ryan led me to expect.
Ryan's been kind. He never gave up on you.
Nor did you."
She glanced away, hoping he didn't catch her guilty reaction. The truth was that she had given up on him long ago. She had not visited him in years, and had come to pay little attention to Axford's less than optimistic medical reports. The last time she'd visited, it had been sufficient just to look through the window.
"I'm so glad you hung in there," she said.
As they talked, he gained confidence.
"Your words meant a lot to me.
I know you didn't think I heard much, but they did."
"That's good," she said.
But she knew that in all her visits she had never said anything to him. Axford had always warned her how pointless it would have been, and she had never had cause to doubt him. when you said that I was still a good man, that I should come back to you.
Yes,
Svetlana said, wondering what else his mind had conjured up during the long years of his exile from reality.
It helped. It reached me. It gave me something to cling to, something to show me the way.
I'm glad, she said. I'm still not ready for the world. You can probably tell that. She smiled quickly.
Early days, Ryan said. But I'll make it.
I know I will. Now that I've come this far, I'm not going back. There was an absolute assurance in his words that stunned her. I'll make it work this time. One day. Not now. Maybe not even this year. I want to do something useful. I want to pay back my debt to Crabtree.
You owe us nothing, she said.
I know how hard it's been out there. I've heard about the deaths, the suicides. You could have let me die. That would have been easier, wouldn't it? One less mouth to feed, one less pair of lungs to fill, one less body to heat.
We are better than that, Craig.
His hands were trembling, she noticed. The company took away my life, my dignity. I invested my whole fucking soul in Deep Shaft. They took that as well. I'll never get back everything they stole from me, but I can make a start with your help.
What do you want?
To serve, he said, to earn your forgiveness. When she had finished stitching the flexies together on the wall, Svetlana stood back and watched the children enjoy themselves. They were in a partition of the gymnasium, once the largest habitable space aboard the old ship. Coloured paper bunting hung in twisted arcs from one false wall to the other, pulled taut by the centrifugal gravity of the room's stately rotation. Party balloons floated in ripe bunches, bobbing where they had come to rest near the extractor vents. Some of them had been twisted into vague animal shapes. Others had already burst, to the delight of some children and the perplexed anguish of others. Wang, who had made the ribbons and the balloons, had been persuaded to stay long enough to judge a painting contest, but he had gone now, back to his work with the vat. Svetlana hoped he would return, if only for the special treat she had prepared for the children later in the party. Wang was popular with the kids. Somehow they sensed that he was the one adult on Janus totally unsullied by anything that had happened on the ship. The one adult everyone liked without reservation. The party was in Emily's honour. She was 5 years old now, in this ninth year of human settlement. There were a dozen other children in the room, most of them younger than Emily. Hannah Ofria Gomberg, the oldest child on Janus, was nearly 8 now, and had taken to supervising the younger children with a precocious sense of duty. She was with Rika Bettendorf now, helping the older woman apply face paint, actually the harmless marker dye they'd once used to scrawl cutting points on ice, to a fractious group of 3-year-olds, turning them into tigers, monkeys, bears, and green-skinned space monsters. It kept the children entertained, although Svetlana wondered whether they would have been just as happy smearing the dye on themselves in abstract splodges. None of these children had ever seen a real cat, let alone a tiger.
"She's a beautiful little girl," said Christine Ofria Gomberg, nodding in Emily's direction. "Your hair, your chin, Barry's eyes and nose. That expression she makes when she's not getting her way."
"Pure me," Svetlana agreed, smiling.
"Yes, I had noticed. I can't believe it's been 5 years. You should talk. Look at Hannah now. She's almost like one of the grown-ups around the other kids. She'll be 11 when we reach Spica."
Christine lowered her voice as Hannah looked their way, conscious that she was being discussed.
"I remember being 11, Sveta. It's as if we have 2 boxes for all the memories we acquire between the moment we're born and the moment we die. The child box and the grown-up box. You can still open the child box when you're an adult, sift through those memories, take them out for examination. But they never feel as if they happened to you. It's as though you see everything through thick glass, putting the world one notch out of focus. But by the time we're 11, everything goes in the grown-up box. She'll always have grown-up memories of Spica."
"Let's hope those are good memories," Svetlana said, and then wished she had said something less pessimistic.
Her dark sense of foreboding about the future did not belong at a birthday party, any more than hilarity belonged at a funeral service. She knew it was futile to dwell on what was going to happen to them when they reached the spike and structure. It was every bit as futile as dwelling on the inevitability of death. For years, indeed, Svetlana's immediate concerns had been so grave that she had not allowed herself the luxury of worrying about that remote event. So much else would have to go right for them before they could even dream of staying alive long enough to meet the aliens. But now it was beginning to look as if things might go right after all. For the first time in years, Svetlana felt as if they were winning the struggle for survival, and that they had a good chance of making it to Journey's End. They had power from the moor, and now they had the means to gather raw materials as well. It had taken time, but lately they had become very adept at harvesting the lava lines, stealing matter from Janus. Soon after that first discovery of the spilled cargo, Wang's analysis had revealed that it contained many elements and compounds that were either in extremely short supply or entirely lacking in Crabtree or the other settlements. Better still, the materials could be manipulated using routine chemical and nanotechnological methods that Wang already possessed. The Spiken machinery might be invulnerable to analysis once it was in place, but the raw matter of which it was made was much more susceptible to human intervention. It could be cut, smelted, vaporized, ionized, even stripped down to its component atoms and segregated into isotopic fractions. It would not mean an end to certain forms of rationing, and the closed-cycle systems would have to be maintained as diligently as ever, but at long last, Svetlana's people had the means to build, to keep building, even to toy with dreams. Wang, too, had made progress. For years his efforts had been hindered because the forge vat was damaged, and his understanding of its functions had only been superficial. Painstaking dedication had allowed him to fix the VAT hardware and repair many of the damaged template files in its memory, but the basic shortage of raw materials had impeded his attempts to fully master its workings. Now he could experiment as much as he liked, and at last he was making useful components, basic medicines and machine parts that actually worked. He planned to achieve much more than that, however. A single VAT was always going to be limited in its usefulness, and that limitation would become more acute as the population grew. He had plans to make another VAT by growing its component parts in the first. Difficult, he said, but not impossible. He could then take some of the replicators from the first VAT and use them to seed the second, so he wouldn't have to fabricate a fully functioning nanotech system from scratch. The second VAT, if all went according to his plans, would be a mere duplicate of the first, but if he could make it work, he would have gained enough confidence to build something even larger. His third vat would have a cubic capacity 8 times the size of the first, which would allow it to cast an entire lander engine in one go. Eventually, he said, he would be able to make a vat as large as the grandest industrial units back in China, a block-sized monster capable of forging an entire ship in a single pass, hatching it like a newborn chick. Svetlana wondered how far in the future he was thinking, and if anyone else had plans that reached that far ahead. The face painting done, the children had gathered around Parry, who was dispensing chunks of chocolate, not the rubbery brown vat-grown approximation, but the real thing. A crate of Snickers bars had turned up during the clean-out of a cargo slot, and now the chocolate was kept under lock and key, strictly rationed and only to be dispensed during parties. The children only received 2 generous bites each, but such was their hyped-up expectation that they might as well have been portions of the finest caviar. Despite the minimal quantities of chocolate involved, it was gratifying how much mess some of the more enterprising kids were able to make, but the real chocolate stash was getting smaller with each birthday, and there were more birthdays to celebrate each year. Soon the kids would have to learn to like the vat-grown stuff. "Come here," Christine said, taking Svetlana's arm. "There's something I want to show you while Parry's got them occupied." "And what would that be?" "Did you see the pictures Wang came to judge?" "A couple of them, but then I had to go and start stitching the flexies together." Christine led her to the table where the paintings had been spread out in all their wet, dripping glory. She peeled one from the table, yellow paint smearing her fingertips. "Dawn Mayer did this one," she said, her tone confidential. "I asked her what it was meant to be. She said it was the bad man." "What bad man?" "The one she hears all the grown-ups talking about." Svetlana looked at the picture, applying mental filters to strip away the clumsy and smudged execution, trying to see what the child had intended. There was a yellow sky and a grey-green strip of indeterminate ground, and a stick-figure man standing on that ground, rendered in a murky shade of reddish-black. The man had nasty scarecrow limbs, arms terminating in tree-like explosions of crooked black digits. The face, as far as she could make out, was vulpine and sleek and strangely menacing. In one skeletal hand the man held something that looked like a broken doll, more red than black.
"I've no idea who that's meant to be," Svetlana said.
"Nor me, so I asked. And she just kept saying he was the bad man. When I asked his name, she said something I didn't understand, at least not at first. Something that sounded like pull or pow. Then it clicked, and I knew exactly what she was saying. And I felt my blood temperature drop about 30 degrees.
What was the name?"
"Powell," Ofria said, with a slow and delicious emphasis. "Powell Kagan."
"Holy shit!"
Svetlana forced her startled voice lower.
"How could she?"
"Because people still talk about him, Sveta. Maybe not in public, but in the privacy of their own living quarters. He's the man who got us into this mess after all. We all know that. It's just that most of us have found a way to move on. We have enough to deal with here without projecting all our hate onto someone who probably died more than a century ago, hopefully in prison, after serving a life sentence for corporate manslaughter, after receiving inadequate analgesics for his very painful terminal illness. But not everyone has such an enlightened view."
Christine shrugged. "He's the new boogeyman, the demon some of the parents use to keep their kids under control. Be good, or Powell will get you, and take you away to his wife." Svetlana looked at the doll-like figure in the man's fingers, and realized that it was supposed to be a child he had stolen. His wife.
"The wicked witch, the mad old woman who lives out on the ice."
Christine put down Dornmayr's painting and picked up another from the table.
"Take a look at this. It's Richard Flagg's picture of Bella, or at least what he thinks she is."
The 7-year-old son of Chieko Yamada and Carsten Flagg had drawn a creditably insane-looking old witch, squatting in a kind of fractured ice-blue igloo under an iron-black sky. Svetlana stared at it in cold horror. She had seen the picture earlier, but its significance had been lost on her. Just a witch, she had thought, never for one moment realizing it was meant to be Bella.
"I never put these thoughts in their heads," she said, as if she needed to defend herself. "The children aren't even meant to know about her. Someone let it slip."
"Who?"
"All of us, Vieta. In those unguarded moments when we forget the kids are around. Can you honestly say you've never mentioned Bella? Never even alluded to her when Emily's been within earshot?"
"Alluded, maybe, but..."
"That's all they need. Kids make their own mythologies, their own angels and demons. All we had to do was give them the tiniest helping hand, the tiniest nudge in the right direction. If they hate and fear Bella, it's only because they've latched onto the way we think about her. They're too young for monsters."
Christine returned the dripping painting to the table. The black line at the top of the picture had begun to bleed a tendril towards Bella's dome.
"Maybe not. In less than 4 years we'll meet the real ones. Perhaps it's time we all started thinking about monsters."
By then the children were done with the chocolate and were swirling around the gymnasium again, laughing and screaming, bursting balloons and spilling drinks and food. Unable to suppress the disquiet that the paintings had provoked, Svetlana clapped for attention. When she spoke, her voice sounded troubled, evasive.
"Hi, kids. Wanna see a movie?"
Damn right they did. They'd been hyped up for it as thoroughly as for the chocolate, and their anticipation was no less intense. She waited until they were gathered before the flexi array, settled down and prepared for the long bout of concentration, silence, and bladder control watching the movie would require.
"We found this movie in the archives," Svetlana said, smiling brightly. "It was lurking there for years, stored under the wrong file name. That means none of you will have ever seen it before. Isn't that great?"
Most of the children nodded their approval. Danny Mayer started to cry.
"This is a film I saw when I was a little girl," Svetlana said, soldiering on. "Even then it was an old film. My mother remembered seeing it when she wasn't much older than any of you. I know you're going to like it, though. It's a film all about a little fish, a little orange fish with one fin bigger than the other one, who gets separated from his dad, and all sorts of magical adventures happen to both of them while they're trying to find each other again. They meet these really cool turtles and, well, I don't want to spoil it. Shall we just watch the film?
There was a murmur of polite, if not overwhelming, enthusiasm. Some of the smaller kids were already looking distracted. Perhaps it would have been better to have said nothing, Svetlana thought. She used her own flexi to start the movie and then took a place behind the kids to watch the show. Finding Nemo wasn't a complete success. It went down well with a handful of the kids, but even then Svetlana couldn't be sure that they weren't just sitting still and looking engrossed, because that was what was expected of them. The reactions of the others ranged from indifference to a kind of bewildered edge of tears dismay, as if she'd forced them to sit through an hour of algebra. They just didn't get it on any significant level. Few of them had seen Bella's old aquarium, so the things swimming around on the flexi screen were simply too unfamiliar to them, alien beings immersed in an utterly alien environment of which they had no experience. A few of the children were sufficiently amused by the bright shapes with human faces, but for others it was too much like watching an endless parade of abstract inkblot forms. They had trouble following the narrative, trouble working out who they were meant to identify with. The sharks, meant to be funny, disturbed them profoundly. When the action shifted out of the water, they lost the thread completely. By the time the movie had finished, half the kids had drifted away to play with the balloons and make alterations to their demon-haunted paintings. Svetlana felt dispirited. She had been in an excellent mood at the start of the party, but by the end of the film she was convinced that they were raising a generation of psychopaths, children utterly starved of the fundamentals necessary for adequate emotional development. How could they have responded so ungraciously to a movie in which she had expected them to take such untrammeled delight? But then she saw the kids laughing again, having their face paint straightened out and desmudged, and she forced her mood out of its rut. She had asked the kids to take instant pleasure in a movie that had been nearly 60 years old before Rockhopper met Janus. As a kid, there'd been things that her own parents had expected her to enjoy, films they'd liked when they were small, but which to her had seemed quaint and colourless and somehow melancholy. And even at this remove, she could remember their quiet, brooding disappointment. They must have worried about her for a moment, but she hadn't turned out to be a monster any more than these kids would. She knelt down, picked up a balloon and punched it through the air towards Emily. While there were children, there was hope, no matter how unamusing they found one deformed orange fish.